We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. The following sermon was given at St. Matthias Family Church, where Philip Jensen was senior minister.
Jesus was an enigma. In pity of the disciples, they don't understand him. Look at the storm in verses 45 through to 52, or 49 to 52. They see him walking on the lake. They think he's a ghost. The poor disciples, you see, they cry out. I mean, last time he stilled the storm and that was enough to scare them, to terrify them. Now he's walking on the water and he looks ghost-like. When he speaks, he says to them, "Take courage, it is I. Be calm." And indeed, everything is calm. The wind dies down. And they're completely amazed. Now that is all a fairly amazing, astonishing, terrifying experience to go through. But notice what they said. They were completely amazed because, for, they hadn't understood about the loaves. Now you're amazed. What on earth has this got to do with the loaves? What has it got to do with their hearts being hardened? They didn't understand about the loaves because their hearts were hardened, and that's why they were astonished when they saw him walking on the water. Confused? Well, so were they. What does it mean to understand about the loaves? And what is there that you could understand about the loaves that would help you understand or help you not be afraid when you saw a bloke walking on the water and stilling storms just by popping into boats and saying, "Don't worry, it's I"? We really are atheists. In our mindset, we have been conned not by the philosophy of science, but by the effectiveness of technology. We actually live in a closed, mechanical kind of worldview, desperately hoping and longing for the sign of the supernatural, a sign of that there is somebody outside the machine, that there is something more than the machine that we're living in, that we are more than machines, desperately looking for the touch of the supernatural, because we think that if the right kind of miracle just happened there, well, then we'd know the answers, then we'd believe, then we'd... But it's not like that. The cynic can always be cynical, the sceptic can always be sceptical of anything that happens. My father taught me, whenever you're watching a musician, you always keep saying to yourself, "It's all done with mirrors." I don't know how it's all done with mirrors, I don't know how they get hats which give you rabbits, because there are mirrors, but I know it's all done with mirrors. And as long as I keep believing that, I'm never really worried by the fact that they can get rabbits out of hats, because it's all done with mirrors. If you're thoroughly and utterly imbued with scepticism, you can always doubt. Doesn't matter what it is, you can doubt. A miracle will never prove to the sceptic that there is anything more than the machine and mirrors. But more than that, what does a miracle prove? If someone can do a great miraculous thing, I stand here, click my fingers, and that organ starts playing, that would be a miracle. For lots of reasons. Not the least, that nearly all the stops and all the pipes that are in that organ are actually not in that organ, they're in a church building 2 miles down the road. So if I snap my fingers and get it to work, you can rest assured that that is a miracle, isn't it? What does it prove? Well, I don't know how you do auditory miracles with mirrors, but it's all done with mirrors. That's the sceptic solution. But the gullible solution is to say, well, he can do it. That proves that he is what? Good or bad? Doesn't prove either, does it? It could be that I'm doing it because I'm God. It could be that I'm doing it because I'm the devil. I mean, they are fairly radically different conclusions to draw, aren't they? Very radically different conclusions to draw. What what miracle you do could point in the opposite direction. In fact, it could prove absolutely nothing, couldn't it? Could prove that we've devised a new system that organs turn on with clicks of fingers. Miracles are not self-explanatory. And it's only because we are locked into our mechanistic worldview and so desperate for the touch of the supernatural that we tend to think that they'll be self-explanatory, that if it happened, then we'd know what it meant. But we wouldn't know what it means. How do we understand Mark chapter 6? For here is a series of miracles. The feeding of the 5,000, the walking on the water, and Jesus not being able to perform a miracle, and sending out the 12 to do miracles. And there is one unusual section, namely John the Baptist's beheading. It's unusual for lots of reasons. One of them is that Jesus isn't the centre feature. In the rest of the Gospel, Jesus occupies centre stage, every section. But this one, Jesus isn't around. What do we make with it? Well, most of us read our Bibles as if it's a series of Aesop fables, a series of morality tales. So in the first section we see that a prophet is without honour in his home country, that little proverb of Jesus in verse 4, that the hometown boy is always faced with the prejudice of the locals, such prejudice that they are blind to what the reality is. And of course this is a peculiarly Australian disease, isn't it? That you really are a nobody until you've made it overseas, and then when you make it overseas we hate your guts. So we never really accept that anybody is an anybody until they are accepted elsewhere and they can't come home. So it is with Jesus that prejudice from over-familiarity can prevent people from seeing. That's a worthwhile message or reminder for us to actually open our eyes and look around at each other and to see that really we have got great things going on. Or again, there is an urgency in verse 11, an urgency about preaching the gospel. So whenever you enter a house, stay there until you leave that town. If any place won't welcome you or listen to you, shake off the dust of your feet and as a testimony against them and go on elsewhere. There is an urgent business we are involved in, and we need to move on and keep on preaching the gospel. And we too often, you see, stick with unrepentant people rather than continue to take the message to the world, to those who haven't heard and would respond. That we need to warn our nation that they cannot forever have people preaching the gospel to them. So we just draw that kind of conclusion. Or verse 18, we see the example of a prophet, a true prophet of God. You know he's a true prophet of God in part because he's hated. It's a sign of the true prophet. But he's a true prophet because he has spine, he has backbone, hasn't he? He knows the truth, he speaks the truth, he sticks to the truth, he loses his head for the truth. There is the sign of a true prophet. He's willing to face the king and call a spade, to actually denounce him even though he's in prison. In contrast, of course, you have the politician, Herod. Oh, what a politician he is. Verse 20, he knows the truth. There's a lovely little expression about the character of political life here and of humans. Because Herod feared John and protected him, knowing him to be a righteous and holy man. And when Herod heard John, he was greatly puzzled, yet he liked to listen to him. It's like the moth and the light, isn't it? Fascinated by it, even though it is destructive. He loves John, loves to hear John. He knows John's telling him the truth. He likes to hear him, but he hates him at the same time, and he doesn't want to hear any more. And he has him locked up. And even though he knows it's the truth and is fearful and fascinated, he is a weak man, isn't he? Whenever there's a weak man, it is Herod. He's weak because of his immorality. He's weak because even in his immorality he gets attracted by the wives, his so-called wife's daughter. He's weak because he's so proud, having made a rash and stupid promise. He won't go back on his word because his pride, you see. His guests will think poorly of him if he doesn't murder this man now. Pride is a silly thing, isn't it? Dreadful, stupid man. And of course, the end result is in this Herod is he winds up spooked by it all. That's where the story starts in verse 14. King Herod heard about this, that is the mission of the 12 that Jesus sent out, for Jesus' name had become known, well known, and some were saying John the Baptist has been raised from the dead, and that's what the miraculous powers are working in him, and others said it's Elijah, and still others one of the prophets long ago. But Herod said, it's John. No doubt, he knows it's John. How does he know it's John? It's not John. He knows it's John because his conscience is got at him. He's spooked by it all. So there's warnings in it, isn't there? Just as the prophet with backbone is an example for us to follow, so the politician, Herod, is one not to follow. And there are examples of Jesus here. In verse 31, you see he takes leisure. Very important example. But you must learn that we are not to always go on and on. Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest, he said. One of the problems Christians get themselves involved in, isn't it, is overactivity. That the whole of world salvation is dependent upon me, and therefore I've got to keep going, 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 going. I can never take time off. I can't just sit down and go fishing. I can't go play golf. I've got to go on and on. And so I work at my job all day, and I spend every night out evangelising, and I spend the whole weekend at church running this and running that. And even my holidays I take up with going to beach mission, then another camp, and then on to a third camp, and then I go and visit my Sunday school class all the rest of the week so I can go back to work thoroughly and utterly exhausted. So on, but look at the example of Jesus, you see. He saw they were tired. He saw they'd been working hard. He said, come on, let's have a break for a while. An important example for us to follow, isn't it? Free your conscience from the workaholism that Christians get themselves caught up in. Or again, in verse 34, notice that Jesus is one of compassion, and we should be like him in that. Or verse 46, you see, he is a man of prayer. His disciples got in the boat to go ahead of him while he dismissed the crowd, and after leaving them he went up on the mountainside to pray. And again, we need to take time every now and then. We need to say, all right, Saturday morning, instead of racing around to do the shopping, clean the car and all that, instead of doing all these activities, I'm going to take the morning off. I'm going to go down to Centennial Park and sit by a lake down there. I'm going to spend some time just alone praying with God. Spend some time doing it. See the example of Jesus that I would follow. Or, again, the morality of in the storms of life, turn to Jesus for help and rescue. The sermon has been preached many times and it's not wrong. He will come, he will bring calm. Now see, in each of these readings of the gospel event, in each of these we can draw great morals, great principles, great examples for our own life. They're not untrue. I think each of those are fair. But what about verse 52? They had not understood about the loaves, and their hearts were hardened. What do you draw from that? Has Mark written this for us purely to set us a set of examples of morality tales, of kind of Aesop fable things? Now, verse 52, it's saying that there is more to it than meets the eye. There's more to what is taking place than just, this is what Jesus did, therefore you should. We're actually going to have to take off some of the outer layers of meaning tonight to try and work out what it is Jesus was doing, what it is that Mark is recording for us. And verse 52 is a great indication that we don't really understand Jesus properly, for we wouldn't have written that as the explanation of the disciples' failure. Well, as Herodias took off the layers, let's now follow her example and metaphorically take off some of the layers here in Mark 6. And we deal with John. Firstly, who is he? Well, we've had John introduced to us from chapter 1 of Mark's Gospel. He came in camel's hair, leather belt, eating locusts and wild honey, living in the desert, baptising people, calling upon the nation to repent, baptising them in the River Jordan, a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins. John comes as the long-awaited Elijah. That is why he is in camel's hair, as Elijah of old was, with a leather belt, as Elijah of old was. That is why he preaches the message he does. He comes as the long-awaited and looked-for Elijah. And chapter 6, verse 15 reminds us of that, and that some people have understood that Elijah is around. You see, they're looking for Elijah. They're confused as to who he will be and what he will be like. But John's Elijah image is very strong. If you remember Elijah, he is in conflict with a king, a wicked king called Ahab, who married, well, he's not so much wicked as weak, who married a very wicked woman called Jezebel, or Isabel, Isabel, woman of Baal, her name means, and that's what she was. Well, just in those parallels you start to hear the similarities. Here was another prophet who preached national repentance, who lived out in the wilderness, who dressed and lived rough. Another prophet who was in conflict with a very weak king and a very wicked woman that he has married. That is the character of John. That is his work. And his task, well, his task was found for us in the end of the Old Testament. Just come back with me again to the end of the last chapter of the Old Testament. It's the easiest way of describing where it is. It's Malachi chapter 4, if you prefer to head from the beginning and go forwards. The very last part of our Old Testament, not of the Hebrew Old Testament, because we arranged our books differently to the way they do, says, chapter 4, verse 5, "See, I will send you the prophet Elijah before the great and dreadful day of the Lord." Sorry, before the day, great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. "He will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, the hearts of the children to their fathers, or else I will come and strike the land with a curse." Before the judgment day, God is going to send his servant Elijah. And that's why the people were looking forward to Elijah coming. But in what form was Elijah to come? Was he to come back as he went in a great chariot of fire coming down from heaven? Some thought that. Was he going to come and rescue out the people who were the saved ones? Some thought that. Was Elijah himself going to come back, or somebody like Elijah going to come? Well, there are all kinds of options. But when John turns up the way he is, there's little doubt as to what he's claiming. And when he enters into this conflict, as Mark records for us, here is the precursor to God's judgment day coming. And so, if we take away Elijah's camel's dress for a while, camel's hair dress for a while, and look at him, what do we see that he comes to do really? Well, he comes to die. The end of Elijah, John that is very different to the first Elijah. The first Elijah is one of the few men in the Old Testament who doesn't die. One of the great things you learn about John the Baptist, and if you're a gory Sunday school boy you never forget, is the head being lopped off. I think it's about the only lopped off head in the Bible. And I've got several children's Bibles with gory paintings of the head. And it's something you can really go to town on, isn't it? Well, John dies. And that is a little bit of a surprise if you're looking for Elijah. In fact, it could even raise the question as to whether he was Elijah or is Jesus Elijah. And so you can understand why people, even though they see Elijah, don't recognise him as Elijah. Because it's slightly different now. And remember, at the death of Jesus, when he is dying on the cross, he calls out, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," and they say, "Listen, he's calling out for Elijah," which he wasn't. He was quoting Psalm 22. But they were still thinking Elijah was to come. Possibly Elijah's going to come down and take him off the cross, was some of the ideas may have been in their head. But no, John comes to die. Why? What's it about then? If he is the Elijah, as Mark is telling us he is, why the death? The parallel is with the death of Jesus. John dies just as Jesus does. He faces a king, Herod, just as Jesus faces a weak ruler, Pilate. Both of them are weak. Both of them are fearful of the prisoner. Both of them know the prisoner is innocent. But both of them, for their own safety's sake, go ahead with the execution. And Herodias is just like the Jews, out of envy, nursing the grudge, having been shown to be evil, pleading for the death of this prophet of God. And in each occasion, the reason for the death is just purely yielding to pressure. And so the prophet and the Messiah die alike. And indeed, they're both similar in their death, for they are buried by their disciples,
verse 29, the end of our chapter here, section here on it. John's disciples come and take his body, just as Jesus' disciples, the secret one, Joseph of Arimathea, and the women, they take his body and bury him. What is it about? Are we now to see John's death as a pointer? Shouldn't be painter, it's a pointer. A pointer to Jesus' death. And you could say, well, Philip, it all sounds a little bit like Eric von Däniken. Do you remember Eric von Däniken? I wonder where Eric is these days. Well, Eric von Däniken wrote a series of books. The most famous of them was called The Chariots of the Gods, wasn't it? And the whole method of argument throughout the book was, this looks like that, therefore it is it. Right? And so you saw some vague circular painting that was on a cave done by our ancestors. And it says, you see how the head is circular, kind of like a space helmet. And so what it was a picture of spacemen who visited us from the earlier days, you see. And then there's another thing that kind of looks like a banana, but that could really be, well, it's very much like a spaceship, isn't it? Here's a picture of a spaceship. They look like each other, so therefore that must be. So you see, our forefathers, they met up with extraterrestrial beings, right? The argument is, it looks like. Now I'm giving you a double look-like argument, a double Eric von Däniken. Here is John the Baptist and he looks like Elijah. Well, that's a fair one because indeed Mark tells you that's who he is. And indeed Malachi says you've got to be looking for him to turn up. And Jesus explicitly identifies him as the Elijah in Matthew chapter 11. So that's fair enough. But now I'm saying it's a double look-like. Not only does he look like Elijah, but the way he dies looks like Jesus. And you should be at this stage saying, Philip, that is far-fetched. Or should you? Well, chapter 9 tells you that I'm right. Basically because I got it from chapter 9. Verse 11, and they asked him, the disciples, this is just after the Mount of Transfiguration, and they asked him, why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? Jesus replied, to be sure Elijah does come first and restores all things. Why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they have done to him everything they wished, just as it has been written about him. Ah. You see, Jesus says that the Elijah does come in order to prepare, in order to restore all things for the coming of the Son of Man, but that the Son of Man comes in order to suffer, which doesn't fit in with people's expectations, just as the Elijah came to suffer. And the two are linked together. You're supposed to be seeing in the death of the Elijah a pointer to what is going to happen when the Messiah turns up. You expected the Elijah to come triumphant. He came to be killed. You're expecting the Christ to come triumphant. Think again, friends. He comes to be killed. And just as you are wrong in your expectation about Elijah, so you're going to be found to be wrong in your expectation about the Messiah. One event is pointing to the other event. And Mark is telling us, by the time we came to chapter 9, in case we missed it in chapter 6, which frankly we all did, Mark is telling us that the death of John the Baptist is not an accidental factor. The death of John the Baptist is what is to be expected from the Old Testament scriptures. It is the plan and purpose of God that he in his life is preparing the way for Jesus, and in his death is also preparing the way for Jesus. And so your expectations about Jesus are now more confused than ever if you're a first century believer. For you and I, it's simple. We know about the crucifixion. We know about the resurrection. That's called hindsight. But have pity on the disciples. They hadn't read Mark's gospel. They didn't know chapter 9 yet. They couldn't just flip over a couple of pages. Have pity on them. You too would have been confused because you don't understand about the loaves either. Well, you won't for a little while yet. Let's have a break at this stage. Then the picture of Jesus in Mark 6, the picture that his contemporaries had, was one of confusion. On the one hand, he's unpopular. On another, he is popular. And what the disciples themselves perceive is quite puzzling. You see his unpopularity in that he troubles people. back in verse 2 in the synagogue, here's a trouble to them. Here's a trouble. You see, the Sabbath came, he began teaching. Many of them are amazed, astonished about him. How can he know all this stuff? Where does he get it from? Or again, you can see that Herod is troubled by Jesus and his disciples. He thinks it's John the Baptist spooking him, but it's actually Jesus and his disciples that are causing Herod the problem. Or the disciples themselves find him a troubling person. He is rejected by some people, those in his hometown. The chief ones recorded for us here, although elsewhere in Mark's Gospel we've seen that. Their unbelief leads them to find offence in him and oppose him. But most commonly, Jesus is just straight misunderstood. Who is he? Is it John the Baptist? Is it Elijah? Is it one of the prophets? What is this new movement in the name of Jesus that is spreading abroad now that he's sending out his 12 disciples? They can't see his glory. They can't deny that something's happening. And so they reinterpret it. Must be a prophet. Must be Elijah, must be John the Baptist. Still today, that is of course the character. There are some people who just reject Jesus. There are some who are troubled by him, but most commonly people just distort him. Oh, I know about Jesus. And then from there on in, it shows they really don't know about Jesus. It's just a distortion of whatever evidence there has. In the first century, Jesus is popular, as I think he is in the 20th century. Very frequently, people like Jesus, even the Jesus they've distorted and constructed for themselves. Who is this? Was on the lips of everybody in first century Galilee. Something big was happening. Something's going down, and they're trying to find out about it. Even if it's distorted, at least somehow it's distorted positively, isn't it? I mean, Elijah was a great one, and so if Elijah's come, well, this is pretty good. Or even a prophet could be a great one, although, of course, in his own town he couldn't be a prophet, but there are some people, you see, in the popularity say, yes, he is a prophet. But what do they conclude by this? What is it that they come to their conclusion and say, yeah, that is what he is? Well, verse 42, you see, what they really like about Jesus. They all ate and were satisfied. Yeah, food in the stomach is a very satisfying kind of prophet. We like the treasurer who can feed us well. We like our bread and games in each and every generation. Somebody who feeds their hunger. Somebody who in verse 13, you see, heals the sick. Well, he will always be popular, won't he? Because sickness is something that's part of our world, that's part of our existence. And if someone can just go and heal the sick, indeed, verse 56, he heals all of them. Wherever they go, he is healing them. All who touch him were healed. Little wonder he's popular. If you've got the man who can walk around the streets and as people reach out and touch him, they're immediately healed, a lot of people will be running after him, won't they? Very popular is Jesus. It's a kind of superficiality in their popularity, though, isn't it? It's the kind of superficiality that we've been warned about and repeatedly are warned about in the gospel. The disciples know a bit more. And the disciples are the ones to whom the attention is going to be focused in the coming chapters of this book. Because they're the ones out of all the crowd who are popularly following him that Jesus is pulling aside and showing more of himself. He speaks in riddles to everybody, but to those who are inside, he explains to them. And so they should know more, they should understand more, because he speaks plainly to them in a way that he doesn't to the others. They share his work. The very things he is doing, they are now doing. Exorcising, preaching the coming of the kingdom, healing people. They are doing the very things that he was doing. And they must share and understand some of it. And so in verse 41, you see, they go around and feed the crowd. They give out the bread that feeds the multitude. They share in the work of Jesus. And they know Jesus as a caring leader. They see it even more than the crowd see it. I mean, people see it in the way he heals, but they're close in on it. Verses 30, 31. When they are tired, he looks after them and promises them, tries to draw them aside for a break. Or in verse 45, again, when they're tired, they've had it, they've done a long day's work, He's a great one, you see, because he sends them on ahead to get away from the crowd and the pressure and the efforts. They know him as one who cares for them. But the overriding impression they have is that he's a puzzle. He's a very puzzling wonder worker. How does he feed crowds like that in verses 35 following? I mean, this is a remote place, they say. It's already very late. Send the people away so that they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. That's the rational response, isn't it? But he answered, you give them something to eat. Well, this bloke really does unsettle them. He unnerves them, doesn't he? You can imagine, it's not actually being comfortable being with Jesus. You make a reasonable, rational suggestion as to what should be done, and he comes back at you with this preposterous notion that you're going to somehow feed them. How could we do that? And he keeps doing this. It's not just once. He keeps doing it. You give them something to eat. That would take 8 months of a man's wages. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give them something to eat? How many loaves do you have here? This is a weird conversation. Can we start at the beginning again? I would like to understand what you and I are talking about, Jesus. Is the kind of response you expect? Go and see. But Jesus keeps in control. Although he's saying preposterous and weird things, he is in control of the conversation. Go and see, go and check. And, well, they've learned enough now to know that you go and do what he says to do, because all kinds of things happen when you do go and do what he says to do, but you can't work out how 5 loaves amongst 5,000 could possibly make the slightest bit of a difference. I mean, there you are. We told you you should go and buy. We told you you should send them home. 5 loaves is the official answer. We've counted them carefully 2 or 3 times to make sure we haven't made an error. Very puzzling. He walks on water. That is relatively puzzling. I mean, he doesn't know about Australian politicians at this stage of the game. This is a new feature, quite new phenomenon. Here is this man walking on the water in the storm. And, of course, the puzzle of him is so, because he looks like a ghost. Reckon he would. Out there in the boat and in the night time, this bloke walking across the water as if he's going past them. Hey, I'd go for the ghost theory. That's as good a theory as any at that stage. And much as I'd have my eyes wide open, I'd be desperately trying to shut them in the hope that it would go away somehow. And yet at the same time, the storm is so bad, I want him to come, but I don't want that to come, whatever it is that's out there walking. Very puzzling, very amazing. And then when he gets in, you see, he says, it's I, take courage, don't be afraid. He tells me to do such stupid things. It's all strange. They're completely astonished by him. Verse 51. See that? Completely amazed. He is an amazing person. He is an astonishing person. He is an enigma. He divides opinion. He confuses even his own friends. Now that is part of what Mark is presenting to us. I mean, we want to draw the morals, you see. We want to draw like the fables. There's the story. Where's the aphorism at the end? Look around in your hometown, there may be a prophet there. Go home, take our Bibles, we've read our Bible for tonight. But that's not what Mark is doing. Mark is saying, this is how Jesus came across to his contemporaries. That's part of what he is saying. There was an unpopularity about him because he troubled people and they rejected him and they distorted him. They couldn't understand him. There was a tremendous superficial popularity because he was feeding them, because he was healing them. But those who were close to him, although they shared in his work, although they knew him as a caring person, they were absolutely astonished by him. He was amazing. He was always doing the unpredictable. And he was saying the unpredictable. And they were ill at ease in the presence of this one. But Mark wants us to know more yet. However, that's far enough. Let's have another break. What are we going to do now? In the days of Jesus, people actually stood to listen to the sermon while the preacher sat down. There's an option for us, isn't there? If you'd like to keep standing, you go for your life. We are not reading the account of a contemporary written for contemporaries. We are reading the account of hindsight. Mark, in chapter 1, verse 1 of his gospel, tells us that this is the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. You and Mark know who Jesus is. We know that this is the gospel. He is writing for us the beginning of the gospel. The people who are involved in the events of the life of Jesus didn't know who Jesus was. That is what they are trying to discover. Mark is recording for us their struggle in coming to terms with this enigmatic, puzzling character called Jesus. He is writing it to people who already know. And he is showing us what the indications were, what the signs were, what the little symbols were that gave away the message that Jesus' contemporaries should have seen, though most of them missed it at the time. One of them is who John is. John was the Elijah of Malachi 4. Now, if you know who John is, that he is the Elijah, what are you expecting next? You're expecting the day of judgment. You're expecting the arrival of God. For the one who comes after Elijah, according to Malachi 4, is God, establishing his kingdom forever. So once you recognise that this bloke here is Elijah, you say, that's very interesting, and you start looking over his shoulder to see who's coming next. For that is the interest about Elijah. He is the one who is the forerunner of even the greater. That's the message John himself gives, isn't it? He says, I'm not worthy to bow down and undo the thong of his sandal. After me comes one who is far greater than I am. Or again, Mark has told us in chapter 1, what John said of himself, I'm the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way. You know the rest of the verse, don't you? See, he's quoting Isaiah 40. When the people of God were promised that a voice would come, that someone would come in the wilderness, preparing the way for the Lord to come and visit his people with salvation. So once you recognise John for who John claims to be, the voice in the wilderness, you again say, okay, John, that's interesting, and start looking over his shoulder to see who's coming next. You see, Elijah points to someone else coming. But now, in Elijah being killed, it points not only to who's coming, but to what's going to happen to him. Although you can understand why the contemporaries wouldn't have grasped hold of that. That is actually saying the Elijah has come, but he has come to be killed. Because the Son of Man is coming, who will rule the universe, to be killed. But what about the bread? The bread in the wilderness. What about that? Well, you need your Old Testament glasses on. That's why we just stopped off and read some Old Testament for a while. You see, the bread in the wilderness is a classic Old Testament image and symbol. Here they are, they're not just anywhere, but they're out in the wilderness, a long way from anywhere. And they're being fed by supernatural bread. It kind of is supposed to ring bells in your mind as to which part of the Old Testament we're going to read tonight. The manna in the wilderness was one of the most fundamental things that happened to the people of Israel, and they are told to always remember it. When they come to the land flowing with milk and honey, remember how God looked after you in the wilderness. Don't presume and say, we're wealthy because we deserve to be wealthy. You're wealthy because God's given it to you. Remember, God took you out in the wilderness, he made you hungry so as to teach you where your bread comes from, where your real life comes from. Every word that proceeds from the mouth of God, it is God who gives you life. And now the people are out in the wilderness again, and a bloke is giving them bread out in the wilderness supernaturally, and they're supposed to be thinking about what is happening. But more than that, notice that what the disciples see, that Jesus has compassion. Verse 34, for they were like sheep without a shepherd. Ah, again, all your Old Testament bells are supposed to be ringing. Because in the Old Testament we're promised in, for example, Numbers 27, verse 17. You write that one, you can look it up later. Numbers 27, verse 17, 16, 17. Moses prays that another man may come who will be able to lead the people into their salvation. Another man who will come who will be a shepherd to the shepherdless sheep of Israel. And now, in the wilderness, just like Moses, another man has come who sees the shepherdless character of the people of Israel and starts to feed them supernatural bread. The symbols are all there.
But in the Old Testament, in Ezekiel chapter 34, God says to Ezekiel, look at the people of, look at the leaders of Israel, look at the shepherds in Israel. Now, they're all corrupt. I'm going to do away with the shepherds, and I am going to become the shepherd of Israel. I, God, Yahweh, the creator of the world, I will be their shepherd in the new kingdom. Who gives them bread in the wilderness? Moses? No, God, through this man Moses. Who is going to be the shepherd for the people of Israel? A man? Yes, no, God is going to be the shepherd. Elijah comes, and who is going to come after Elijah? God. And now a man comes feeding people and shepherding them across the wilderness. Who is it that's turned up? You see, the miracles are not there so as to give you the gee whiz wow. The disciples had gee whiz wow, and they couldn't make head nor tail of it. They just was wow, this is astonishing. Lots of things are astonishing. But if you look at what is being said in terms of the Old Testament imagery of what is being said, who is this man who provides now for the sheep in the wilderness the supernatural bread of life? And on the waves of the sea, he climbs into the boat and says, don't be afraid, it is I. Well, who is it that walks on the water? In Psalm 77, it's God. You see, the psalmist there that we just read, he's worried about life. He's under the judgment of God. He can't see that God is merciful. Where's the God's promises to save his people? He said, I can't see it. And I thought to myself, well, what I'll do is I'll think back to the old times, to the times when I've seen God saving people, and I'll reflect about that. And so he starts to think back to the great time when God saved people. When was that? Well, it was the Exodus. It was the time when God met us out in the wilderness. And what did God do? Well, he walked right through the Red Sea, splashing the waters back. He is the God who can walk through the ocean. That is our God. And now we see a bloke walking across the water. And you say, yeah, well, Philip, I mean, how am I supposed to know that this is now saying it's God? Well, he gets in the boat and he says, don't be afraid, I am. Our translation's correct. You can translate it, it is I. But the Greek is, I am. Which, of course, is the name of God. For Moses met God in the burning bush, and he called out to God, who will I say that you are? And God says, say, I am. That's who I am. I am. And here is a man who's just walking across the water saying, don't be afraid, I am. Who do you think's getting in the boat? Do you see that they are completely amazed? They are astonished. But they shouldn't have been astonished if they'd understood the loaves. If they had looked beyond just having their stomachs filled with bread when they were hungry, if they looked beyond stopping the riot of 5,000 hungry people by giving them bread, if they looked beyond their own embarrassment and not knowing how to organise the loaves and all the rest of it, if they'd looked beyond the supernatural gee whiz miracle of what had taken place, if they just stopped and thought about who is the shepherd of the sheep of Israel out in the wilderness who feeds them with supernatural bread, if they'd understood the loaves, then it shouldn't have astonished them that he walks on the water and calls himself, I am. For who comes after Elijah? Here is the naked truth then, if we can go back to stripping off veils like Herodias' daughter. Miracle mongering really misses the mark. It misses the point of the whole thing, you see, because miracles don't prove God. Miracles really don't prove Jesus. The miracles point to the meaning of Jesus. But not if you don't have your right symbolic glasses on, not if you haven't read your Old Testaments, not if you're ignorant about what is taking place. For some years now, we've been tyrannised by our milkman. I've mentioned him on previous occasions. He comes fortnightly to collect our money. And he always comes with he stopped doing it now, thanks to this story I'm about to tell you, but he used to come all the time with some newfangled science fiction-y, occult, extraterrestrial thing that he'd just read about and would ask me to comment on and give my learned theological judgment about. The usual opening line was, "Anything new happening in the church lately?" To which I would foolishly always say, "Oh no, not much." To which he would then always say, "Yeah, that's what I expected." And they said, "But have you read?" And then would tell me something new in the world. And they were all fascinating things. Russian experiments in black boxes that could contain people's auras, and you could actually store up an aura. And then you got little blood samples from Australia and you sent them over there and they put them in these boxes and the aura would give a reading and tell you exactly what was wrong with you. And then all kinds of, you know, Philippine healings. And it just went on and on. And it was always miraculous. It was always astonishing. It was always beyond the mechanistic worldview. It was always that kind of stuff that was just defied any rational explanation and which proved the existence of supernaturalism. And I never had an answer. I could never think quickly enough to really do anything other than say, "Here's your check." You know, I mean, and retire back defeated for another Saturday morning and plan to be away next time. But my dear wife, she beat him in a single sentence the morning that I was able to shove her out of bed to go and pay.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.